Today on Against the Grain, what does nonviolence mean? What does it mean to be committed to nonviolence in one's activism and everyday life? According to Kazu Haga, nonviolence is more, a whole lot more, than refraining from violence. I'm CS. You'll hear the veteran trainer in Kingian nonviolence talk about his book, Healing Resistance, a radically different response to harm, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We against them. We are good, they're bad. They are cruel or corrupt or misguided, and because of what they are doing, we are being harmed. And so we come to resent or hate them, this president, that police chief, those polluters, the list goes on. But where will acting out of resentment and hatred get us? To a better, more peaceful world? Kazu Haga believes, he is convinced, that nonviolence is the way, the only way, to get to a world in which all people can achieve their full human potential. But by nonviolence, he's not simply talking about doing no harm. He's talking about a principled way of life, one that actively confronts violence and injustice, one that restores relationships and helps create what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called beloved community. Kazu Haga is a trainer in Kingian nonviolence who works to empower incarcerated communities, youth, and activists to work for beloved community. He's the founder of the East Point Peace Academy, and he's played leading roles in a number of social movements. Haga's new book is Healing Resistance, a radically different response to harm. Earlier this year, Kazu Haga spoke at an event sponsored by the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. Today, we'll present portions of that event, and later this hour, you'll hear remarks that Haga shared with me. CIIS Public Programs furnished audio of the event, which has been edited by yours truly. Here's Kazu Haga speaking on February 12th.
Early in the intro, I start talking about how when I was 19 years old, I started facilitating nonviolence trainings. This was when I was living in Massachusetts. And after a couple of years of doing them, like something felt like it was just deeply missing in the trainings that I was leading, so I stopped doing it. And so I'll just jump in from the middle of the introduction here. It says, I realized during that workshop that the stuff I had been teaching at 19 wasn't, in fact, nonviolence. It was nonviolent civil disobedience. I have been training people to go into mass demonstrations without throwing a punch. While that is certainly one application of the theory of nonviolence, I realized how limited of an understanding I had. If nonviolence is simply a set of strategies and tactics that do not use physical violence, then the Ku Klux Klan could argue that they are using nonviolence when they rally. Neo-Nazis could argue that they are using nonviolence when they march, and that doesn't feel right. Something about the work of nonviolence has to be fundamentally different from the work of the KKK or neo-Nazis. 50 years after his assassination, Dr. King has taught me that a commitment to nonviolence is a commitment to restoring relationships and building beloved community, a world where conflict surfaces as an opportunity to deepen in relationship, a world where all people understand our interconnectedness, a world where, as stated in the Kingian nonviolence training curriculum, all people have achieved their full human potential. Nonviolence as an ethical choice stems from a deep understanding about the impact that violence has on all people, those who experience it, those who perpetuate it, and those who witness it. It is about acknowledging that violence itself is the enemy that we need to defeat, not the people who are caught up in its cycles. Nonviolence is a worldview that speaks to the impact of violence, harm, oppression, and injustice on the human condition. It is about the dynamics of conflict and how to transform it. It is about an unwavering faith in the goodness of people and an undying commitment to healing ourselves and society. It is about stripping away the layers of trauma and separation and remembering the core of who we are. It is about coming home. I'm just skipping forward a couple of paragraphs. In my work in prisons, I've had the privilege to witness the transformation of countless people who have committed the most horrific acts of violence, including homicide, into the most compassionate, dedicated peacemakers I know. I've had the honor of witnessing healing dialogues between people whose lives were brought together by tragedy, between the person who almost beat another to death in a mugging and the survivor of that crime, between mothers and the people who took away their children, between two men who killed each other's best friends. I have come to believe that if these depths of healing are possible on those scales, then there is no conflict that is too large for us to transform. In each of those cases, it has been through love and understanding, not shaming and punishment, that transformation was made possible. I'm not naive enough to think that social transformation is possible without a powerful movement that will need to use militant forms of nonviolent direct action to push for change. But even in nonviolent movements, direct action oftentimes begins with an assumption of separation. We are the good people, and we need to use direct action to harness power so we can overpower those other people. It is still about forcing our will over the bad people. Our language and thinking is still couched in the worldview of separation and domination. I have to believe that it is possible to do things differently, that it is possible to build a movement that is, quote, disruptive as a riot, Dr. King's words, yet deeply grounded in love and understanding, a resistance movement that sees its purpose as healing the wounds of society. There is no separation between the personal and the global. A holistic understanding of nonviolence presents us with an opportunity much greater than what either a movement of healing or a movement of resistance can accomplish on its own. We need that. I am sick of fighting for crumbs. I've been part of countless movements and campaigns where we have spent so much time and resources fighting for one policy change, only to look up and see that we are still swimming in injustice. I have been part of so many circles in prison where incredible healing has taken place, only to look up and see 2 million more incarcerated souls that need healing, with more on the way every day. I am convinced that only a movement that is grounded in a principled approach to nonviolence can get us to where we need to go. A principled approach to nonviolence has an explicit goal that is big enough, not just revolution, but the realization of beloved community, and tactics that are militant enough to create systemic changes that we need without perpetuating harm while engaging in it. We need resistance. We need to resist injustice. We need to resist violence. We need to resist our own tendency to fall into blame, resentment, greed, hatred, or despair. But we need to do it in a way that is healing to everyone.
That's Kazu Haga reading from the introduction to his new book, Healing Resistance, A Radically Different Response to Harm. We go now to more of his presentation. First, he takes up the task of defining nonviolence, and then he talks about how long nonviolence as a philosophy has been around, and also how his understanding of what nonviolence is shifted.
It's actually, in some ways, for me, a lot easier to talk about what nonviolence isn't. So I'll start there. And I'll start by sharing a story that's in my book as well, and a story that I've shared a bunch of times in my workshops for anyone who's ever been. In Kingian nonviolence, we make a distinction between nonviolence spelt with a hyphen and nonviolence spelt without the hyphen. Because when you put the hyphen in the word, it separates the word and it turns it into an adjective. And non-hyphen violence, all that says is something is not violent and something is the absence of violence. And I talk about in my book how that is the biggest and most dangerous misunderstanding of the idea of nonviolence, is that people think that as long as I'm not being violent, then I'm practicing nonviolence. And the story that I want to share is I live in a neighborhood in Oakland called Funktown, which is a beautiful neighborhood. It's one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the country. And it also has, you know, its fair share of challenges. And so there's a lot of conflict outside my window every day. And about 10 years ago now, I was taking a nap in my apartment and I was woken up by a commotion outside. And there was an argument happening, and arguments happen all the time in my neighborhood. So I was just trying to go back to sleep. And the argument kept getting worse, and it kept getting worse, and it kept getting louder. And I finally got out of my bed and looked out the window. And there was a woman on the ground who was getting beat. She was right below my window. I live on the second floor. And she wasn't not only getting beaten, but she was screaming for help. And so I jumped up out of my bed and I put on my shoes and I ran downstairs, opened up the gate. And by this point, they had gone across the street. I was still going on. And I ran across the street and I managed to break up this fight. And by the time I got down there, about 15 of my neighbors had heard the commotion and they had all come outside. And they were just watching this woman get beat, not doing anything to help. And I always argue that all of my neighbors who were just watching this woman get beat were practicing non-hyphen violence, in that they weren't being violent. They were explicitly being not violent, right? They weren't throwing the punches. They weren't throwing the kicks. And you could even argue that I was being more violent than my neighbors were, because I used a limited amount of physical force to pull the two parties apart, and I might have caused some harm in the process. So if our understanding of nonviolence is simply to not be violent, then it's easy to justify being a bystander and witnessing the killing of unarmed black people by the police, the destruction of our planet, rises in homelessness, increases in drug use, all of these things, and just say that's none of my business. I'm just going to stay in my corner and meditate and, you know, and buy organic groceries and consider myself a nonviolent person. But nonviolence is not about what not to do. Nonviolence is about when you see violence and injustice in your community, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to engage with the harm and with the violence and with the injustice and try to transform that situation? And so, you know, one of the principles, the first principle of nonviolence is a way of life for courageous people, because in order to make that kind of fundamental transformation in society, it can't just be a switch that you turn on when you go to a protest and then you turn it off when you're home, or even when you're in the organizing meetings, organizing the protest, right? And so, yeah, it's a worldview and a way of life and a way that we understand the world and try to walk in the world. I had an opportunity to interview Clay Carson once years ago. He's the founder and director of the Dr. Martin Luther King Research and Education Center at Stanford. And he said that Dr. King didn't start a movement, right? That he was just like one kind of point in a movement that has been going on since the beginning of human history. And so in that sense, while my particular training has been under the lineage of Dr. King, ultimately nonviolence is a timeless set of teachings. And for me in my story, it just happened to have come through Dr. King. But I had, I started facilitating nonviolence trainings when I was 19 years old. And then I felt that something was missing in the trainings that we were doing. And so I stopped doing it. And I stayed involved in social change work. It's pretty much all I did since I was 17 years old. And fast forward 10 years after I stopped facilitating these nonviolence trainings, like during that whole time, I was involved in a lot of different movements, but the word nonviolence didn't really mean much to me. And in 2008, in the fall of 2008, I had the opportunity to work for another movement elder, Harry Belafonte. And through his relationship, because of Mr. Belafonte's relationship with Dr. King, the organization that I was working with, that Harry Belafonte started, had chosen to use this training philosophy called Kingian Nonviolence as its core training philosophy. So this organization, The Gathering, was going around the country doing these Kingian Nonviolence trainings. And I was on the executive committee of the organization. So when the training came to Oakland, I was like, I guess I should go check it out. And in 2 days, like, my life completely changed. After 10 years of doing nothing but social change work, I thought I had some idea of what the word nonviolence meant and some idea of who Dr. King was, and it turns out I knew none of it. And so in those 2 days, I gained this like really intellectual fascination with this theory of nonviolence. And 2 months later, a young man named Oscar Grant was shot and killed in Oakland. Most people probably know that story. And I ended up on the steering committee of the coalition that came together to respond to the shooting. And having just taken this training, like, I could just feel from the very bottom of my heart that we needed a nonviolent response in this new way that I understood the word. But having just taken this 2-day workshop, I didn't know how to articulate it. And so I found myself just like stumbling through my words and getting booed at community meetings and trying to convince people and trying to talk to people about this newfound like wisdom that I just couldn't, the words were just not coming out of my mouth. And so that summer I decided to go to the University of Rhode Island, where every year they do an intensive training to certify new trainers in Kingian nonviolence. And I traveled there that summer and met Dr. Bernard Lafayette, who is the co-author of the Kingian Nonviolence Curriculum, who was on Dr. King's senior staff, and got to meet him and was trained by him, and I've pretty much been doing that work ever since. So, you know, over the times, like, I've definitely found that like my path into the work of nonviolence was through Dr. King.
Kazuhaga is his name. He spoke about his work and his new book at an event sponsored by the California Institute of Integral Studies on February 12th, 2020. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Kazu Haga is a trainer in Kingian nonviolence, founder of the East Point Peace Academy, and a veteran activist. His new book is Healing Resistance, a Radically Different Response to Harm. We return now to more portions of this event. After Haga talks about the importance of mutual liberation, he goes into the six principles of Kingian nonviolence, and then you'll hear him discuss Gandhian nonviolence.
There's a famous quote, and I write about this too, that a lot of people are familiar with. It comes from the Aboriginal peoples of Australia that says that if you are here to save me, you're wasting your time. But if you're here because your liberation is bound with mine, then we can walk together. And that's a quote that's like very popular in activist circles. And I'm convinced that most people who quote that don't actually believe it. That when activists say justice for all people, that most often what they mean to say is justice for all of my people. And that justice oftentimes comes at the expense of justice for those people. And Dr. King, the famous quote too, he said that we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied by a single garment of destiny, that what affects one person directly affects all people indirectly. And these ideas of this interwoven web of reality, that what affects me directly affects all people indirectly and vice versa, is this, it's a universal principle that we either believe in or we don't. This thing that I oftentimes talk about, it's like the universe doesn't weave separate webs of interdependence based on political affiliation, right? Like we either believe in interdependence and mutual solidarity and mutual liberation, or we don't. And in nonviolence, I think that is one of the core teachings, is that we are not free until all people are free. Right. And when we say all people, we actually have to mean all people, or the principle, just the very fundamental core teaching of that principle just completely falls apart. So, yeah, the six principles of Kingian nonviolence is like at the core of the theory. And it's amazing that you can take six sentences, and I probably could talk about it for 6 hours. And I wrote whole chapters on each one of them. So principle one is nonviolence is a way of life, courageous people. That nonviolence is a way of life. And because we understand nonviolence to be about asking ourselves what we do about violence and injustice, as opposed to just saying, I'm not going to be violent, that takes incredible courage. It takes incredible courage to stand up to injustice and to resist injustice. And also there's a whole other level of, I quote one of our other trainers in Soledad Prison, who once said that it took me no courage to commit homicide, that was an act based entirely on fear. And the most courageous thing I have ever done was to show up to a group and share all of who I am, all of my insecurities and my shame. And that was the most courageous thing that he's ever done. And so I really found that a lot of the trauma healing and RJ work that happens in prison and doing that work is, it takes incredible courage, and it's deeply, deeply an important element of the work of nonviolence. Principle two is that the beloved community is the framework of the future. Again, this idea of beloved community being a world where all people have achieved justice, and we're not there yet, so that's why it's the framework for the future. But I oftentimes tell people, because people oftentimes say, oh, like, my church community is my beloved community, my family is my beloved community. And it's like, yes, and, because building beloved community isn't about loving the people that are easy to love. Right? Building beloved community is about cultivating the type of compassion that allows us to love the people that are difficult to love, the people that are like on the, quote, the other side. And if we're not doing that work, then we're actually not doing the work of building beloved community. Like, loving communities are important and they should be celebrated. But when Dr. King talked about beloved community, that's the world that he was talking about. Principle three is attack forces of evil, not persons doing evil. The idea that people are never the enemy, that injustice is the enemy, that this idea of separation, violence, that's the enemy that we're trying to defeat. Principle four is accept suffering without retaliation for the sake of the cause to achieve the goal. That's a mouthful. It's about partially about acknowledging that if we are going to stand up to injustice, then it will be hard for you and you will probably suffer along the way. But and that's whether you choose to use violence or nonviolence to resist injustice, right? if you accept the fact that you're going to suffer, then it gives you a different relationship to that suffering, and it can actually make you stronger. But if you go into, like, I found this with a lot of activist communities, it's like, yes, we're going to resist injustice, but if they hurt us, then we're going to get really mad that we're being hurt, as if we should expect it to be easy and for the systems of injustice to just, like, give up and right? And so the acceptance of the inevitable suffering that comes with resisting forces of violence is, I think, a really important practice in nonviolence. And also, there's a story that I oftentimes tell that when I was a kid and I was getting into trouble, as long as my mom would scream at me, it was easy for me to ignore her. But the moment that she started to cry, like, all the walls that I would build would come crumbling down, and I could understand the impact that my actions were having on her. Because there's something that happens to humans when we see human suffering. And so part of the work of nonviolence is accepting that suffering on Main Street in broad daylight, and to, like, show the world what that suffering looks like, to expose the injustice of these systems. And that narrative of, like, if you're able to maintain nonviolence even in the face of state repression, that paints such a clear picture of who's standing on the right side of justice. And that, like, moral argument is one of the most important, quote-unquote, weapons we have in nonviolence, right? And so choosing to accept that suffering can actually help us move towards our goal. And if we accept too much of that suffering, then it turns into internal violence. And so the fifth principle is avoid internal violence of the spirit as well as external physical violence. Internal violence can manifest as hopelessness and desperation and apathy and negative self-talk. But I think more importantly, it oftentimes manifests as hatred and resentment. And then the last principle is the universe is on the side of justice. And coming from more of a Buddhist background, I think I interpret it a little bit differently than how King saw it. For him, I think it was just a deep act of faith. But for me, I always talk about how, you know, when you Google the word justice, do a Google image search, it's the scales of balance that comes up, right? That's how we understand this idea of justice as balance. And so when you look at it that way, I always say that every time a young person gets shot and killed in the streets of Oakland, that is evidence to me that the universe is just. Because I look at all of the investments that we make into systems of violence, not just the 500-year legacy of violence on this country that I was talking about earlier, but, like, we invest in guns, we invest in broken schools and broken prison systems and broken policing systems and unjust economic policies, and we invest in drugs and we invest in violent media and we invest in all these systems of violence. And then when we see violence in our communities, it's like, what is wrong with the universe? When that's all we've been putting out there. And so to me, as long as we invest in systems of violence at the rate that we're investing in, then it is just, it is balance, it is the order of the universe that will make sure that we see those returns. And so I think it's up to us to invest in different things and we'll see those returns. A lot of scholars who studied the work of Gandhi kind of retroactively said that Gandhi was always involved in three realms of nonviolence, and that for him, the word nonviolence meant these three things. One was self-transformation, self-purification, which was the work of spiritual practices to align our values with our practice. And kind of now that we have science like trauma healing, I would incorporate that into it, right? Doing the work that we need to do to rid ourselves of resentment and hatred and making sure that we're able to actually, like, walk our talk. And then the realm of what's called constructive program, which is about, like, building the institutions and the systems that our communities need, and that we don't need the state's permission to take care of our communities. And Carlos Saavedra from the INE Institute, a close friend, sometimes says that even in our most successful movements, oftentimes our demand is to get the state to do something for us. And we need to start doing for our own communities. I mean, the Black Panther Party was a great example of that, right? It wasn't just the guns. It was all of the amazing work that they were doing to serve their community. That's all constructive program work. And then finally, the work of what Gandhi calls satyagraha, which is the kind of, like, nonviolent civil disobedience, direct action, like the political resistance movements, the movements that are in direct confrontations with the powers of injustice. And that we need to be doing all three of those things at the same time. And my friend and colleague Chris wrote a book called The Gandhian Iceberg, where he said that, yeah, these are the three things that Gandhi was working on, but if Gandhi could explain it for himself, he wouldn't have seen it as three circles coming together as a Venn diagram, that he would have seen it as an iceberg. Partly because the iceberg is like one chunk of ice. It's not three separate things coming together. Like the work of self-purification, constructive program, and political resistance is the same work, and we need to see it that way. But also because the part of the iceberg that's beneath the water is the work of self-purification, because for Gandhi, that was the biggest part of the work. And it's also below the water, so you can't see it as much. And then the realm of constructive program is the majority of the work that is visible. And then at the very tip of the iceberg is political resistance work. Like, we only resist when the things that we're trying to build is being threatened by the powers that be. We don't resist just for the sake of resisting. And Satyagraha is at the tip of the iceberg. And so it's the thing that you can see from the farthest on out. So when we look back historically at movements, we only see the protests and the demonstrations, and we don't see all the other work that was happening in community. But it's perhaps an even more important part of the work on nonviolence.
The voice of Kazu Haga, that's Kazu Haga. Today we are presenting portions of a talk he gave about his work and his new book, Healing Resistance, A Radically Different Response to Harm. Haga is the founder of the East Point Peace Academy, a core member of the Ahimsa Collective, and a trainer in Kingian nonviolence, a philosophy that comes out of the legacy of Dr. King. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Later in the hour, you'll hear Kazu Haga in conversation with me, elaborating on issues addressed in his talk and his book. We return now to more excerpts of his talk given 3 months ago.
I think people who do a lot of restorative justice work and transformative justice work, at least intellectually, understands that you can't shame people into transformation. That if someone causes harm, by shaming them and isolating them and calling them bad people and criminals, that it doesn't work to transform that person. And yet when it comes to direct action and when it comes to these social problems, we feel like we can shame the other side into transformation. And, you know, one thing that I've been playing around with in these fierce vulnerability workshops, which are these workshops that East Point has developed over the last year or so, is that, you know, I have a family member who has a lot of unhealed trauma. And like over the years, we've had many conversations with her about her relationships with money and men and her son and work and career and all of these different things. And at some point, I realized that she has some like deep core traumas. And if that core trauma doesn't get healed, then we're always going to be dealing with these manifestations. And at a larger level, this country has an infinite amount of issues that we're dealing with, whether it's police violence or environment or the broken government or economics or education, all these things. But this country has some core trauma. This country is built on the genocide of indigenous peoples and the enslavement of African peoples. And those are core traumas that we have never healed. So until we heal those things, there's always going to be manifestations of that trauma. And I've found that, you know, one of the most healing things that we can do on an interpersonal level is to create spaces where people feel safe enough to talk about their biggest shame, right? There's a great quote that I learned in prison through Ahimsa. I think it's actually a Brené Brown quote who says that shame derives its power from being unspoken. And when you can give space for people to speak to our shame, it's incredibly liberating. But you have to create containers where people feel safe enough to say, yes, I did this thing, and to trust that they're not going to be isolated from beloved community. Because if they feel like if I admit to this thing, I'm going to get thrown out of society, they're never going to admit to it. And being able to say I did this thing is part of their healing process. And I think when we think about the legacies of slavery and the legacies of genocide on this land, and even some of what's happening now on the border and all these things, like these are things that the country should be ashamed of. And how do we use direct action to actually create a conversation that feels safe enough for the country to talk about that and to really sit with the shame of gaining all of these privileges out of such harm and oppression and violence. And so, yeah, like the same ways in which we do restorative justice work in the prisons, I'm trying to picture what that could look like in direct action spaces and resistance spaces. One of the stories that inspired me was there was a direct action that happened in North Carolina where a group of activists occupied the governor's building. And before they went and did that action, they had a conversation about, like, what are the characteristics that we want to embody in this action? So they actually made an agreement that they wouldn't chant, that they wouldn't hold signs, that instead they would sit in circle and just talk. And many of them coming to tears about this was an action to try to get a pipeline that was being proposed to be stopped. And to talk about why they're there, and to talk about the fear that they have about their kids and the indigenous communities that they're in relationship with and the impact that it would have on them. And yeah, like, I don't know if I've ever been to a lot of direct actions where we're leading with vulnerability as our strength, right? And that's the idea of fierce vulnerability, is like, what kind of healing work do we need to do on our own so we can show up in direct action spaces and lead not with our anger and not with resentment, but with our own vulnerability. There's an elder named Lanise Pinkard, who's also an incredible activist, and she says that we need to have a movement that has the courage to have a relationship with our heartbrokenness. Mm-hmm. And all these issues actually should break our hearts, and we should be leading with that. But if we're leading with our heartbreak, then we need to do our own healing work so that, I love quotes, there's another quote that says, preach from your scars, not from your wounds. Mm-hmm. Like, we need to do enough of our own healing work so that we can build these scars over these wide open wounds so we can lead from that place. It is true that we have the capacity for violence. That is part of our nature. That is part of our reality. And yet there's something about violence that also breaks us. This is something I heard from a guy named Paul Chappelle. And he says that if violence is part of our nature and if it's part of who we're meant to be, then why does it break us? Like, shouldn't we be able to engage in it without it causing this permanent, oftentimes, damage? And I always think about that because, yeah, like, I get that part of our nature is that we are capable of it. But what does it mean for us that we are capable of something that also causes permanent damage and PTSD and anxiety and depression and all these things? And maybe the things that are actually a part of our core nature that we're supposed to be, who we're meant to be, are the things that uplift us and fulfill our potential as human beings, right? And unfortunately, we don't always get to see that because violence has been so institutionalized. Like, we talk about how white supremacy and patriarchy and all these forms of violence has been institutionalized and are constantly being reinforced by our media and by government and by law enforcement and schools. And we're just swimming. We're fish in water. Like, we don't even see how deeply we're being conditioned into violence and separation. And we're talking about capitalism, how deeply capitalism conditions us to compete against each other and to see ourselves as separate. And part of the work of Kingian nonviolence specifically is to take the teachings and the practices of nonviolence and go into the same institutions that perpetuate harm and violence and institutionalize its antidote. And like, if violence has been institutionalized, then the medicine also has to be institutionalized. So what would it look like if our institutions, schools, media, government, were created in a way that it was constantly reinforcing the best of who we are? And I think that's part of the work of nonviolence, is working within institutions specifically to really integrate these teachings so that we're constantly being reinforced with a different way of relating to each other. Because otherwise we fall back on our default, right? There's another quote that I love. It's an ancient Greek soldier who said that we don't rise to the level of expectations, we fall to the level of our training. Right? Like, we have these wonderful expectations about wanting to create beloved community and wanting to be kind to each other and wanting to love our enemies. And then when the conflict happens, because of the ways that we've been conditioned, we fall back to our defaults. And for most of us, our defaults in conflict are responding to conflict in ways that create separation, because that's how we've been trained. And so how do we train ourselves to have a new default? It takes a while. It takes institutionalization. It's a complex world. these like black and white ways of looking at things is actually a form of violence, right? There's another quote says, the black, white, right, wrong way of looking at the world is the most pervasive way that our minds have been colonized by the state. And so, like, I believe in beloved community as the goal. I believe in reconciliation as the goal. And it's going to be a really messy process to get there. And I am a lifelong fan of martial arts. I think people should know how to defend themselves when, if and when necessary. I also think that oftentimes advocates of nonviolence find themselves making judgments against communities who feel like they have no other recourse than violence to survive. And I think those judgments are oftentimes seething in privilege. It's easy to judge people for using violence when your life and your community isn't being threatened with annihilation on a daily basis. And so, like, I think violence is very effective in keeping you alive. And I think there's great value in that. But I'm not interested in just barely surviving, right? Like, I'm interested in beloved community. And so understanding that violence can be very effective in keeping you alive and keeping you safe and keeping you protected, and there's value in that, and we shouldn't judge people for that. And if our goal is beloved community, then it's not enough, because violence can never heal those relationships. And if we're not healing relationships, then there's always going to be conflict. And there's a incarcerated trainer that I work with, a Kingian trainer in Soledad prison named Bilgi. We call him Professor Bilgi because he's one of those guys that, like, he never forgets anything. He's a brilliant guy. And he said to me once that resolving a conflict is about fixing issues and reconciling a conflict is about repairing relationships. Mm-hmm. And you can use nonviolent tactics to resolve issues. Mm-hmm. You can even use violence to resolve issues. You can use violence to force a policy change or even a change in government or whatever. Those are fixing issues. But if we're not repairing relationships, then that conflict and that resentment is going to surface somewhere else around some other issue. And so if we're not working to heal relationships and mend relationships and strengthen relationships and move closer to beloved community, then there's always going to be more reason to use violence at some point. And so, not to put a blanket judgment on violence, but to make it very clear that violence alone will never get us to beloved community. And so it's the nonviolence to me is the exploration of, like, what more is needed to get us to beloved community.
Kazu Haga, a trainer in Kingian nonviolence and founder of the East Point Peace Academy, he spoke earlier this year at a CIIS-sponsored event. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Now, Kazu brought up a number of things in his talk and in his book Healing Resistance that sparked questions in my mind. So he joined me recently, and I began by asking him to elaborate on what internal violence is and how it can manifest in hatred and resentment.
Dr. King, in his time, talked a lot about what he called internal violence of the spirit. And I think a lot of what he meant by that is things like negative self-talk and things like thinking that you're never going to be good enough or that you're never going to be able to change. Those are forms of internal violence, are ways that you're hurting yourself. But also the kind of hatred and resentment that builds up when you, particularly when you've experienced things like harm and violence, and that hasn't gone, it's gone unaddressed, and the trauma that comes from that hasn't been healed. That can easily manifest as hatred towards the other person. But there's a beautiful quote that comes out of the 12 steps tradition that says hating someone is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. And that, you know, I think we all have known what it feels like to be so weighed down by hatred and anger and resentment at somebody else. And when we think back to the moments where we've been that person, it's never our, like, best moments in life, right? It's never our most productive moments. It's never the times in our lives where we've actually been uplifted ourselves. And so when you really think about it, when you hold on to hatred, when you hold on to resentment, that actually hurts you a lot more than the person that you're hating. You know, nonviolence isn't saying to not hold individual people accountable for the harms that they cause. And in fact, accountability is actually a critical component of that person's own healing process, right? Being able to hold themselves accountable for the harms that they caused is critical in their own path of healing. So accountability is a big piece of it. But I think when you're holding on to hatred and resentment, it's actually difficult to bring people to real accountability. It becomes much easier to start to attack and shame that person. And that doesn't hold that person accountable, but it also weighs you down. When I was first starting to study nonviolence, particularly Kingian nonviolence, there were two quotes from Dr. King that really stuck out to me. One is when he said that, "I've chosen to stick with love because hate is too heavy of a burden to bear." And in another sermon or in another piece of writing, he said that nonviolence is not just a refusal to shoot your opponent, but it's a refusal to hate your opponent also. And so those two quotes from Dr. King really helped me to understand that a commitment to nonviolence is also a commitment to doing whatever healing work that we need to do to be able to let go of the anger, to be able to let go of the resentment, so that when we're in the process of working to hold people accountable for the harms that they committed, we're not coming from a place of resentment and hatred, but we're actually coming from a place of wanting real accountability as part of their healing process as well.
It's fundamentally important, you say in your talk, that we love the people who are difficult to love, the people who are on the other side, including people who take actions we strongly oppose. How do we cultivate the compassion that allows us to love those who are difficult to love?
Yeah, that's something that I say a lot, that the work of nonviolence and the work of building beloved community is to be able to cultivate some form of understanding and empathy and an understanding of interdependence with those that are difficult to love. And, you know, love is a tricky word. Love can mean many different things. I talk about that in my book too, how it's very helpful in the Greek language. There's multiple different words for love. And when Dr. King talked about things like loving your enemy, he wasn't talking about cultivating the same type of love that you have for your friends or family, right? That would be ridiculous. That's not what he was asking for. But he was asking us to acknowledge the interdependence of all human beings and of all life on earth, and to acknowledge that at the end of the day, our liberation is bound with the liberation of all beings. And I think that's, you know, obviously a really difficult thing to do and not something that one does overnight. And so I oftentimes compare the practice of nonviolence to something like weightlifting, where if you're trying to bench press 500 pounds, you don't lift 500 pounds on your first try, right? You start with 25 pounds and then work your way up to 50 and then 75 and then 100. You have to start slow. And I think it's the same thing with ideas like loving the people that are most difficult to love. I think you have to really work towards it. And it might mean starting by reconciling with a friend that you had an argument with that you haven't talked to in a while. It might mean starting with getting involved in a metta meditation practice. It might mean doing more random acts of kindness to strangers. Those are easier things to do that cultivate our heart's capacity to have compassion for those that are harder to love. You know, I do things like I listen to a lot of right-wing conservative podcasts and listen to conservative radio shows as a way to try to build more understanding, right? So these are practices that I have that hopefully help me kind of grow my capacity to hold more love for more people.
If, as I know you argue in your book, and I think it's one of those principles of Kingian nonviolence, if it takes incredible courage to stand up to violence and injustice, where do we get that courage? How do we summon that courage?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of it for me, it really goes back again to this idea of interdependence and this idea that I'm not going to be truly liberated until all people are liberated. And I think that sort of understanding of interdependence, that I am because you are, that I am part of something that's much greater than myself alone, will give you incredible courage. And I also think that it's important to be doing this work in community, right? In like social movement spaces, because I know that I as an individual don't have nearly as much courage as I feel when I'm part of a larger group. I remember, you know, times when I've been in major demonstrations and there's
30,000, 40,000, 100,000 people in the streets with me. It is such an inspiring and empowering feeling. And so I think a lot of the work that we do is to bring people together in community so that we can be stronger than any one of us as individuals can be. And so I think that's the work of a lot of people who are advocates of nonviolence, is to learn to bring people together in community so that we can be doing this work in community and in relationship.
What is the primary difference between Gandhian nonviolence and Kingian nonviolence?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot more similarities there. Like, it is just part of the same lineage, and it just manifested differently based on the kind of cultural and historical context that they arise from or arose from. And so I think it's important to think about how in Gandhi's movement, like, his movement was about independence, right? So I think there was a much stronger focus on building up the economic power of his people and really separating themselves from British power. It was about a lot of constructive program work, as Gandhi called it. And Dr. King's work was largely about integration. And I think in that story of integration, we lose a lot of the stories about some of the powerful work that was happening, particularly in small communities in Alabama and Mississippi around economic development and things like that. But as far as Dr. King's work, he wasn't as focused on that. It was much more about integration. And so I think there was a big difference there. I think Dr. King, even as a minister and the son of a minister and the grandson of a minister, because, again, of the cultural context of Gandhi, I think it was a lot easier for Gandhi to really sell nonviolence as a spiritual practice in a way that I think it was a little bit harder in the civil rights movement. I think for Dr. King, it was a deeply spiritual practice. But I know for a lot of his followers, nonviolence was seen just as a tactic and a strategy, right, for building movements. And I think for Gandhi's movement, it was very clear that it was also a spiritual practice. And so the Kingian tradition, I think, tries to really talk about nonviolence is much more than a strategy and a tactic. And, you know, people may not resonate with the idea of it being a spiritual practice, but I think at the end of the day, we really view the philosophy of nonviolence as much more than just how do we organize protests without throwing a Molotov cocktail, but what does it really mean to live into this idea of interdependence and to really commit ourselves to the healing of relationships and to know that the struggle is so much larger than just us as individuals.
Kazu, I'm going to assume that in the process of being in so many activist circles and steering committees and organizing meetings that you've been around a lot of people who have felt a lot of hostility because of the injustice they face, the marginalization they face, and they want to lash out and they want to take down their opponent. Based on that, how hopeful are you that in fact, people can, you know, kind of not just on a individual level, but on a collective level, like in significant numbers, work toward the kind of the aspirational spiritual goals you've set for us in terms of not leading with hatred and resentment, not being so focused on demonizing one's enemy, one's political enemy, and thinking in a broader and more generous and more big-hearted way.
Yeah, I'm actually very hopeful about that. I'm an eternal optimist. I think that's just part of my personality, so that definitely helps. But, you know, one of the things that I think about is I'm a Japanese person, right? I was born in Tokyo, Japan. And as a Japanese person, I think a lot about the history of the Japanese Imperial Army and the harms that we committed all throughout the Pacific Islands and Asia during World War II and other periods of time, particularly in places like Korea and China. And I think about how we as Japanese people who are, you know, stereotypically considered to be polite, nice people, just overnight turned into these monsters who committed atrocities that are just exemplifies the worst of human behavior, and how quote-unquote normal people, everyday people, went into the military and just started committing these atrocities left and right. And I think about how delicate our human minds are, that in the blink of an eye, an entire group of people can just turn into these monsters. That scares me. But I also think that that points to the reality that we can also be flipped in the other direction, right? And I think we see it all the time after natural disasters and after things like that, where people are suffering at great scale, that people, it's like they turn a switch, and we are also capable of turning on that switch and calling out the best of who we are. I think it's just a matter of people who believe in this kind of work being able to model that for people publicly. And I think once people see that being modeled out there in the world, I think it actually is easier than we might think to turn people around and to really cultivate the best of who we are. And, you know, Dr. Bernard Lafayette, who is the guy that trained me and all of this stuff, he says that this idea of turning the other cheek is really about when someone is using violence against you, that they're showing the worst of who we are as human beings. And turning the other cheek is about turning that around and showing the best of who we can be as human beings. And so I think if enough of us model that, then people will follow.
That's Kazu Haga, founder of the East Point Peace Academy, veteran activist, and a trainer in Kingian nonviolence. He spoke with me about his new book, Healing Resistance, A Radically Different Response to Harm. The event audio you heard earlier this hour was drawn from a podcast produced by CIIS Public Programs. It was edited by yours truly. The event was hosted by Sonia Shah, associate professor at CIIS and director of the Ahimsa Collective. For more information about CIIS Public Programs, its podcast series, and upcoming live-streamed online events, click on the link we've provided at againsttothegrain.org. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.